36. Right now, 35 in Kenosha, 34 in Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's now 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, it was 1 week ago today that experts and analysts across the country were taking a look at last week's midterm elections. And of course, 1 week ago, we knew a whole lot less than we do now, with plenty of key races across the country too close to call in what turned out to be a remarkably close midterm election, much closer than at least some had predicted. And in the wake of all that has occurred, with actually, I think, a tiny handful of races still to be determined, we're in a better position to understand this midterm election as we sit down with Dr. Gerald Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College, and someone who has joined us on any number of occasions to offer his analysis of our elections, and sometimes sitting in a predictive format ahead of elections, and probably more often than not in the wake of elections, helping us sort out what happened and why. So, Professor Gerald Mast, it's great to have you back on the Morning Show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Greg. It's always good to be here.
Thank you for being here. So, one of the things we were talking about before we went on the air is that there were widespread predictions that this midterm election was going to constitute a red wave, and that just did not materialize. I think one of the things that we should first talk about is what caused those predictions to be made in so many quarters that this election was going to turn out the way it did, and then let's talk about the ways in which it, in fact, did not turn out that way.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things that would lead one to think that it should have been a very strong election for the Republican Party. Things that had to do with the historical patterns of voting in elections. Historically, midterms tend to be a difficult period of time for the president and the party, the president's party in the White House. And that has to do with a number of things. there's this backlash against the White House's party because the party out party, the party that didn't win the White House, is angry for having lost. Their voters are disappointed because of the election, perhaps disappointed in the kinds of things that the White House is doing, and are more motivated to get control of government back. The party that won the White House is a little more complacent, a little more satisfied on one hand, less motivated by anger, if you will. Maybe a little bit more disappointed because the reality of winning an election is always a bit less than the promises that are made during an election. So people's expectations are built up by campaigns. And so you have this differential attitude on the one hand of a party angry, motivated to get back in power, and a party a bit more complacent. So we expect to see presidents lose seats in Congress during the midterm. That's the conventional thing. When we look at a little deeper into how who votes how and why, you know, you can think about the electorate as composed of different buckets of people. There's a Democratic bucket and a Republican bucket, and the people who are very comfortable calling themselves Democrats or Republicans, we know how they're going to vote. Their votes are very predictable and for the most part unsurprising, and very little is going to change them. I mean, every now and again you'll find a hardcore Democrat really turned off and cast a vote in the other direction, or vice versa, hardcore Republican will vote in the other direction. But for the most part, their votes are understood. Then we have buckets of leaners, so people who lean Democratic or lean Republican. And they often vote for the party towards which they lean, but not always. They're a little bit less loyal to the party. And then in the middle, there's our true independents, people whose votes really are up for grabs. So those first two buckets, the hardcore Democrats, the hardcore Republicans, we don't need to worry about them. It's those three buckets in the middle whose vote is on some level contingent upon environmental factors. So what are the environmental factors that we look at to kind of figure out, well, how is this election likely to play? And we looked at things like the economy. That's the kind of the big one. And different scholars will have different metrics that they favor. But when the economy is doing really well, we might say, oh, the party in the White House is likely to hold those losses down, right? They're more likely to minimize the fallout, so to speak. If the economy is not doing well, then we would expect those leaners in the out party to for sure join the out party. Some of those leaners for the in party are probably going to defect, and the independents are probably going to punish the incumbent party. Another variable that we look at is the approval ratings of the president, and in a way those correlate pretty closely. If we look at what the situation is moving into the midterms last week, inflation is clearly a problem. There are some possible, you know, signs that it's starting to become less of a problem. Maybe we're moving in the right direction. Prices are stabilizing a bit. But I mean, it's clear that we haven't had this level of inflation since the end of the 1970s or early 80s, and that has bothered quite a few people. President Biden's approval numbers are nothing to write home about. They're pretty low. They've been hovering in the low 40s fairly consistently. You take those things into combination and you think, well, the Republican Party really should do very, very well. One of the things I found interesting about this round of elections is that the evidence that we have about people's intentions to vote didn't really suggest this, right? Mm-hmm. So the polling numbers all kind of were pointing towards a very close contest, despite the historical expectations, the conventional wisdom, and so forth. But the last three election cycles have been undersampling Republican support, and so the polls overestimate again the last three election cycles. Not all pollsters, but on average, the industry has been underpredicting Republican turnout, and so I think that going into last week's election, many election observers were looking at those relatively close numbers and expecting recent history to repeat itself, that the polling was probably under sampling Republicans. But as it turns out, the pollsters have figured out a way to kind of correct for those errors in the previous cycles. And so the election as it was really was pretty darn close.
So this time around, we should have believed the polls, as it turns out. I mean, we had no way of knowing going into it. But in retrospect, the polls were very close, and they did not predict a red wave.
Correct.
They predicted a very, very tight midterm election. And in some respects, what I've heard said, maybe this is overstating it, but I have heard said that this was for the president's party, the incumbent party, if you will, the most positive or successful midterm election except for 2002, which of course was in the wake of 9/11, which was a very, very different world and very, very different scenario. But otherwise, it was remarkable that President Biden's party did as well as it did in
right.
this midterm election. That just typically doesn't happen.
Correct. And I think that can probably be explained by some important recent political developments in American politics. Partisanship is hardening. The parties have polarized. The Democratic Party is much different from the Republican Party. Once upon a time, the parties had a fair amount of overlap. Wasn't enormously rare to have a fairly liberal Republican or a fairly conservative Democrat. And in those kinds of situations, you can imagine voters being willing to support one party or the other if there was indeed this sort of overlap. When you eliminate that overlap, the choices become much starker and very different. And so there are just fewer people who lean in one direction or the other who really deserve the term leaner. They really are going to vote vote for the Democratic Party.
So those are smaller buckets
I would argue that those buckets are smaller as a result of this polarization and the differentiation between the two parties. So if the parties are polarizing, then it just doesn't matter that much what the environmental factors are. People are going to vote for the party they're predisposed to vote for. And so our choices are baked in, so to speak. But because the two parties are also very close to each other in strength, there's an enormous amount of parity in the national political environment. That means that even though environmental factors like how the economy is doing, the president's approval ratings and so forth, those environmental factors will have a very small effect. But because the parties are so close to each other, those small effects might actually dictate the outcome of the election.
It can come down to that very,
right.
very easily.
Right. That's right. So we're not we shouldn't necessarily see big swings, but the swings that we do see will have significant consequences.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Mast, a professor of political science at Carthage College. And we're, of course, talking about last week's midterm elections in which the Democrats retained control of the Senate. They did lose the U.S. House, but not by nearly the margin that was widely predicted.
Have they called the House? I'm not sure. The last I saw was 217 votes. I mean, I think that you're right. In effect, the Republicans are almost certain to
you're right, though.
That
maybe is not. Yeah, I've not heard that is actually officially the case. But everything points to a narrow.
You'll have to bring me back on Friday.
Yes. Okay, there we go. Absolutely.
If they don't have it by the end of the week.
We should talk real quick about the fact that what is the difference between if the U.S. House had swung dramatically right. towards the Republicans, I mean, with the possibility of the Democrats losing 30, even 40 seats, versus what in fact occurred where they lost a modest number of seats, and assuming the Republicans regain control, it will be a very narrow control. What are the consequences of that, of it being a very narrow majority versus a wider majority?
The consequences are significant for the kinds of policies that you're likely to see come out of the institution. So if you have a majority with a margin of 25 seats or 30 seats, you can afford to lose some people, right? You don't have to worry so much. And so if your margin conversely is a 6-seat margin or an 8-seat margin, you really can't afford to lose many people. So the degree of internal cohesion within the majority is enormously important in order to get things passed when your margin is really small. And the degree of internal cohesion is going to be a factor of environmental kinds of variables. How united is the party? Are there big internal divisions, and so forth? So there's that. But it also hinges significantly on the political talent of the leadership. And so the political talent of the leadership can bring a group of people who are unlikely or not necessarily all that happy about coming to the table and falling in line into just such a position in order to pass a bill, get it across the goal line, so to speak. Moreover, when the leadership faces a fractious majority, then there's, you know, very significant limits on what they can get done.
Let's talk about the way in which things played out not only on Capitol Hill, but for instance in governorships. And of course, the post of governor was up for grabs here in the state of Wisconsin, of course, with incumbent Tony Evers fighting off Tim Michaels. But the Democrats won gubernatorial races in Pennsylvania and Kansas and New York and Massachusetts and Maryland and Minnesota and Michigan. And so, I mean, anyway, by and large, those were it was a good night in that respect. Let's talk for a moment about the governor's race here in Wisconsin, which was hotly contested, of course. Tim Michaels, in some respects, in going down to defeat, was indicative of a lot of, if not all, similar candidates really across the country. It was not, for instance, a good night for election deniers and others in that sort of that camp of the Republican Party.
Right. If we characterize the Republican Party somewhat oversimplified terms, but I think it's still relatively justified to do so, is as kind of establishment Republicans versus Trump Republicans. I think it was a much better night for establishment Republicans last week in the midterms. And the Wisconsin primary really did pit Rebecca Clefish, a kind of an establishment Republican, the anointed one of the kind of the party leaders, against an outsider, the outsider being Mr. Michaels, who was, of course, endorsed by Mr. Trump. And so one of my observations, I guess I would say, is that I think that the Republican Party in Wisconsin shot itself in the foot by choosing Mr. Michaels, in part because I think that for independents, the whole election denial phenomenon is unpalatable. They don't particularly like that. They're not responding. At least that's what the election suggests, that they're not responding well to that. They're willing to shift to the Democratic Party over that. And then I would also point to abortion. And Mr. Michaels took a pretty hard line on abortion in the wake of the Dobbs v. Jackson decision by the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, pushing the issue of abortion to the states. And, of course, in Wisconsin we have a law from the late 19th century that had been overruled by Roe v. Wade. Take Roe v. Wade out of the equation, that law becomes back into effect. And you take Tim Michaels, his position on abortion was really rather hard line and much out of line with the bulk of the Wisconsin electorate. And I think that that really made the difference at getting Mr. Evers over the line.
Mandela Barnes, of course, fell short in his challenge of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. But I think a lot of people found it remarkable that it was as close a race as it was. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think that Mr. Johnson, who I will note, took a fairly moderated view on abortion in the wake of Dobbs v. Jackson, essentially saying Wisconsinites should decide this, putting the issue before the voters as a kind of referendum. And where, however, you know, you fall on the issue of abortion, I think that many people would respect making it a kind of a democratic choice. So I think he minimized the damage that he could have been exposed to by the abortion issue by taking that tact. I think he was fairly prudent in assessing his relatively small degree of appeal to Wisconsinites. He's popular in the Republican Party, and that's kind of about it. He's very unpopular amongst Democrats, and independents in Wisconsin, those independents that are still out there, there's not many of them, but because the two parties are so close to each other in size, they matter. Those independents have floated back and forth on Mr. Johnson, for the most part, not particularly approving of him. And so what Mr. Johnson chose to do, instead of trying to make a positive case for himself as deserving re-election, he tried to delegitimize Mandela Barnes as an acceptable alternative choice. And so he ran a very, very negative campaign, hitting Mr. Barnes on issues of crime in particular. I would say that is the biggest and most effective line of attack against him. And it is concerns about crime and social order and race relations and so forth that I think allowed for Mr. Johnson to increase his level of support in the rural side and stem his losses in the suburbs enough to hold on.
One of the things we talked about before we went on the air was that voter turnout in Milwaukee County was a little bit disappointing or unexpectedly low. And, of course, one would suspect that that would hurt the bottom line for a candidate like Mandela Barnes.
Yeah. I mean, I am working off of just first impressions here. I haven't seen a lot of the data at this point. But what I have seen suggests that overall turnout was pretty darn good for a midterm, I would even say in Milwaukee it was pretty good for a midterm. It was down relative to 2018, and so that's been the benchmark that people have been using here. But 2018 was a record kind of turnout for a midterm, of course, because of the controversies associated with Donald Trump in the White House after his victory in 2016. That dynamic, the out parties angry and upset and trying to take back control of government, played out to a T in 2018.
I'm so glad you said that. So in other words, for numbers to be down from 2018, that's not a sign of apathy or anything particularly troubling.
Things returning more to normal.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. You'd mentioned also, as we were briefly talking about that one of the decisions that apparently Mandela Barnes made, he and his staff, was to focus a lot of his campaign efforts in rural Wisconsin, where, of course, conventional wisdom would suggest he was not going to do as well as the incumbent Senator Johnson. An interesting choice, but given how close this election was, it sounds like that wasn't a bad choice.
Yeah, it's hard to know at this point. Again, I guess you'd really need to do a sophisticated dive into the numbers that I don't have access to at this point. But it does raise a question of kind of campaign strategy that has raged in the Democratic Party. Should the Democratic Party really go after voters in areas that they're not particularly strong in, right? Should they fight for those rural voters? Should the National Democratic Party fight in states that, you know, they're probably not going to win? Or should they, for strategic purposes, essentially write those areas off and focus on those areas where they have realistic chances of winning? And, you know, that's a debate that the Democratic Party has been fighting for a number of years now. So it seems to me that the Barnes campaign decided we're going to fight in areas where we might not expect it to do all that well. And they did okay, it seems, better than you might have otherwise expected in some of those areas. But they didn't do as well in Milwaukee. They overwhelmingly won Milwaukee, the city, and the close-in suburbs of Milwaukee. But turnout wasn't as high as they needed. It was almost as high. I mean, the decline in turnout in Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, seems to be, relative to 2018, which again was a high watermark, seems to be about the margin of his loss.
One number that I understand was down, but maybe it's similarly down like other numbers just compared to 2018, but was number of young voters. What's your understanding about what the turnout was for young voters, either in Wisconsin or kind of in general?
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure how much to trust the numbers that I've seen at this point. So first impressions, I would say they seem to be pretty good. Not as good as very recent elections, but if you step back and look at the larger historical picture, better than youth turnout in the 90s and 80s and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that matters quite a bit because there's big differences of partisan identification and partisan vote preference across age cohorts. And so the big election exit polls that we had from last week show clearly that voters in their 20s and early 30s very significantly favored Democratic candidates. Voters in their late 30s and 40s marginally, in a smaller margin, favored the Democrats. Once you get over the mid to late 40s and up, then they favored the Republicans. And so to the extent that the Democratic Party can maintain historically relatively high turnout amongst young people, then their chances are much improved.
What is your take on Kenosha County, which once upon a time was a Democratic stronghold, but has really tilted pretty decisively the towards the Republican? What is your sense of what's going on there?
Well, a few things are pretty clear, right? So the historical pattern is that cities are Democratic and rural countrysides are Republican. That is still very much true in the state of Wisconsin. I would argue that the best way to understand the schism between Democrats and Republicans is urban culture versus rural culture, more so than liberalism and conservatism. So that's true in Kenosha County, and you know that is definitely the case. Republicans are to do well west of the eye, and Democrats have been much more competitive on the other side of the interstate. But a recent kind of development in partisan identification has been this education gap, and so the education gap is this. White Americans, this is true for white Americans much more so than non-white Americans. The relationship kind of goes away once you stop looking at white Americans. For white Americans, those with a college degree are shifting into the Democratic Party. Those without a college degree are shifting into the Republican Party. And so there's a really large gap now based on education. Historically, the city of Kenosha, very blue-collar town, and a strong union town, right? We are a city of manufacturing, an auto car town. And as you know, we all know, manufacturing has been leaving the area where the union, since Chrysler has left, has diminished in importance. And those blue-collar white workers who have, since the 1930s or even earlier, have been identifying with the Democratic Party, are now viewing the Republican Party as a preferable choice, increasingly on average. So you know, blue-collar white towns like Kenosha are going to be harder for the Democratic Party to compete in.
One of the things I've heard said is that some of the most distinctive success stories in this election, that should be a lesson for both parties. And, for instance, one of the higher-profile races was in Pennsylvania, where is it, John Fetterman, I think, beat Dr. Oz. And of course, Dr. Oz, there's a newcomer to the political arena, but somebody with very, very high name recognition and so on, and with the backing of a lot of headline supporters. But that challenge was beaten back fairly decisively. And the story of that success of Fetterman and the loss by Dr. Oz, not that that election plays out in the same way everywhere. I mean, there are things that are unique for that situation. But what do we take away from, for instance, a high-profile campaign like that?
Well, in a way, I do think that there's elements of that race that are fairly idiosyncratic. Fetterman is an interesting character, right? He is in a way, adopts a kind of Trumpian persona. That is to say, he is anti-establishment. He refuses to go around in suits. Mm. He's famous for wearing cargo shorts and a hoodie. He's very much trying to get blue-collar folks to identify with him. In a way, this is perhaps a corrective measure for the larger trend associated with that education gap that I just mentioned. As
right.
blue-collar white people are beginning to shift towards the Republican Party, Fetterman is the kind of candidate you would pick to try to push back against that trend, to get blue-collar folks to identify with him as a way to increase your support. And Dr. Oz is perhaps an unfortunate choice in that regard, in that he's a doctor, he has an ethnic background, and maybe this is the sort of thing that would work in suburbs, but not necessarily in blue-collar towns.
Plus the fact that he's from out of town. I mean,
right.
in no way is...
That has never been a particularly good selling point in American politics. The carpetbagger term comes from our distant past, but it applies today. This idea that you are not necessarily one of us. Famous study of congresspersons and their constituents. Identifies some key things that members of the House try to establish with their constituents. They want to build a sense of trust, and that trust is predicated on three key things. One, and the first is identity. I'm one of you. All right, mm. we are from the same place. We are from the same cloth. We share, in some sense, the same values. And so politicians try very hard to pitch a persona that makes that appeal. The second is a qualification. I'm qualified to this job. I have experiences and knowledge and so forth that will make me competent at it. And the third is empathy. And that is to say, I understand what your problems are and I care about them. If politicians can do those three things, then they establish trust and capture the vote of their constituencies.
Hmm. Let's talk about the fact that it was a really rough night for former President Donald Trump, who, of course, just yesterday announced he's running for president once again. But some analysts, of course, could look at the results of this midterm and really see it as, to some extent, a repudiation of Donald Trump and Trumpism. And, of course, in the wake of the elections, former President Trump has been lashing out at a whole lot of people within his own party,
right.
And vice versa. Quite a number of notable Republicans have been very frank in fixing blame on President Trump. What kind of a scenario are we looking at in terms of the Republican Party right now and what appears to be a really painful divide? I mean, even more so than we have seen.
Yeah, it's a dangerous moment for the Republican Party. you could say it's a dangerous moment for the country when somebody is going to run for president who faces a list of potential felony charges that include things like conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct the official proceedings, seditious conspiracy. All of these things, right, are serious kinds of charges potentially. And so nobody should lose sight of that. That is, I think, a set of circumstances that warrant perceiving the country on some level as facing some peril. Shifting our focus more narrowly to just the Republican Party, there are also some real potential challenges here, right? So I think that the elections do show the significant limits of President Trump's popularity. He's popular within the Republican Party, and that's about it.
Well, the entire Republican Party, but
correct, right. Or not even that. So his unpopularity amongst Democrats guarantees high turnout amongst Democrats whenever he's a part of the election, and he's unpopular amongst independents, which means the GOP will struggle to win in the middle if he is part of the equation. So there are a number of Republicans, for very strategic purposes, are hoping to move the party beyond Mr. Trump. The Speaker of the Assembly here in Wisconsin, Robin Voss, made statements to that effect very, very recently, saying, look, it's time to move on. We need to look for new leaders. Nonetheless, there are a significant number of Republicans who still remain very, very loyal to Donald Trump. Donald Trump has really changed the Republican Party. He has brought in many of these white blue-collar voters without a college education who see him as an important vessel for a kind of political movement that they think is very, very necessary for them, their interests, and the country at large. So getting rid of Donald Trump for the Republican Party is a difficult, difficult kind of thing. Who could do it? Who are the alternatives to Mr. Trump who could successfully beat back his attempt to win the nomination? Everybody is talking about the one Republican who had a clearly, unambiguously good night last week, and that is Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is in a number of ways a very impressive political figure. And so right now it seems like he is the non-Trump alternative for those Republicans who are not happy with Mr. Trump's refusal to fade away. But it's not clear that Mr. DeSantis will take him on. And if he does decide to take him on, he clearly wants to be president. That much is clear. If he decides to take on Mr. Trump, then there'll be a very, very difficult fight between the two. The question becomes, if he fails to win, how does Mr. Trump handle the failure to capture the nomination of the Republican Party? Will he concede graciously
and throw his support behind DeSantis?
Will he do what he can to mollify his supporters to make sure they remain in the fold of the Republican Party? Or will he be less than gracious? Will he be unwilling to do what is good for the party? And I think we all know the answer, or the likely answer to that question. And so the Republican Party faces one of two outcomes. Either Donald Trump wins the nomination, or they face a situation in which somebody else captures the nomination, and DeSantis seems like as good a guess as any at this point. But in that situation, you have a very angry and upset and humiliated Donald Trump, who is a dangerous, dangerous figure,
right?
For party unity.
Sure. And then would he end up being another Ross Perot or Theodore Roosevelt with the, what was that, the Bull Moose Party?
Right. That exactly.
Changed the result of that election.
And Ron DeSantis can see that potential scenario, and so he might choose to just avoid it. He's a young man. He's only 44 years old.
Right. Really, really fascinating question. On the Democratic side, in some respects, there's also an unsettling scenario that is what does President Joe Biden do in this next election? I don't remember just how old President Biden is, but he is not a young man and has, as we've already talked about, quite low approval ratings, for whatever that's worth. And so that is also a far from clear picture at this point.
Right. He is the oldest at this point, oldest president.
Oldest president
right
ever?
Now, right now. And so every day in office, he's breaking a new record. It is unusual for a party to want to change horses in midstream. It is, if you're the sitting president, whether you're going to, you know, be the party's nominee is usually up to you, right? And so, you know, the degree to which Democrats are not particularly impressed by Joe Biden at this point really is fairly unusual. On the other hand, because we are in a midst of unprecedented's the wrong word, unusual polarization, right? Democrats are going to vote for Joe Biden if he decides to run, and certainly in the general election, there's no doubt in my mind. The question becomes: if he decides that he wants the nomination, will he receive primary opposition? I suspect not. I wouldn't be shocked if he does. And there's not a good track record of presidents seeking re-election, having been challenged for the nomination by their
that hurts party. Their prospects of re-election.
Jimmy Carter was challenged by Ted Kennedy. George Herbert Walker Bush was challenged by Pat Buchanan. So it's a bad sign if he gets challenged.
Right. If President Biden, for whatever reason, maybe including, you know, maybe issues of health that might arise or other concerns, if he were to not seek re-election, it's a really interesting scenario, of course, because we had a wide array of candidates last time, of which he obviously emerged as the nominee. And it also seems to me that this is a scenario in which Vice President Kamala Harris, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to have a particularly high profile as vice presidents go. And I'm not sure if she would be operating from a particularly strong position of strength in such a scenario
Doesn't seem like it. In his defense, I would say that President Biden has a pretty strong record of accomplishment in terms of policy. And so the first 2 years of his term have been pretty fruitful as far as a policy accomplishments go. Also, polarization works in his favor. And I think for the most part, people are find him an acceptable, decent person. I think we have to be frank about the effects of age. The biggest concerns, I think, are around how sharp he is, his capacity to effectively communicate a message, a set of agendas, and so forth. And so people are looking for a younger choice, a new generation to take over. Normally, you would say the vice president is on deck, so to speak. But she hasn't had a particularly high profile to the extent that she has been given some responsibilities, particularly around immigration, hasn't gone particularly well. Her numbers are not all that impressive. So if Mr. Biden decides not to run, and I thought that during his press conference in the wake of the midterms, he kind of left the door open, saying he'd sit down with family and talk about what their choices really should be. If he decides not to run, then I think the field really does open up. And, you know, I think that there are a fair number of Democrats who are excited at the possibility of new faces in this regard.
Interesting. I want to finish out with the topic of voter suppression. I wish we had longer to talk about this. We just have 5 minutes or so. You had already talked about how in these midterms, by and large, candidates who are kind of in the camp of election deniers, of calling election results into question, they did not do well. By and large, most American voters were not drawn to such candidates on that perspective. Voter suppression, of course, is kind of another issue, in some ways maybe related. What is your sense of the American people and their level of awareness and concern when it comes to charges of voter suppression taking place across the country? And what is likely to be done about that, do you think?
Well, like many things, polarization affects perceptions of electoral problems, if you will. Republicans are much concerned around this idea of vote fraud. People voting in elections who are not entitled or eligible to vote in elections. There's really no evidence that voter fraud is a significant problem in the United States, where elections are run by committed public servants whose primary, perhaps exclusive objective is to get the vote count right. Vote fraud is part of this election denial phenomenon that unfortunately we're having to deal with. And for the most part, it is primarily a Republican perception. Democrats, conversely, are more concerned about vote suppression. That is to say, policies that are designed to lower the ease of access to voting, ostensibly to prevent election fraud, which again, there's not much evidence to think is actually a significant issue. So the concern is that by changing the rules of how voting is allowed, right, we'll push the turnout downward, and people who would otherwise be eligible to vote are not eligible to vote for reasons that have to do with unnecessary restrictions associated with being able to vote.
Or voting will become so inconvenient that they will just not bother to vote.
Now, I'm not a fan of making it harder to vote, particularly because I don't perceive much in the way of any evidence to think vote fraud is a significant problem. On the other hand, in a way, if Republicans are guilty of being motivated by a problem that doesn't really exist, I think that the Democrats are, in some sense, exaggerating the threat of vote suppression because of the following. And there's really good evidence for this that has been gathered in studies of election outcomes in the wake of policies that are perceived to suppress the vote, and that is, in some circumstances, turnout goes up, not down. And that is because people perceive the effort to suppress the vote and are more motivated to turn out as a result. And the party being targeted by efforts to lower the turnout puts in extra effort to try to overcome those obstacles amongst their supporters. Now, you could say, and I think rightly, that we shouldn't have to generate an enormous amount of effort to help people get to the polls and successfully cast a ballot, despite rules that are not particularly justified. I mean, all that's fair, but I don't see vote suppression as particularly successful at this point.
Interesting. It's maybe a misguided attempt in some respects.
Right, or counterproductive.
Right, counterproductive. Right, yeah. That's a very good way to put it. Well, that's really intriguing. And of course, I think it has given a lot of people a kind of a new awareness of the preciousness of having the right to vote. And I think none of us are taking that for granted or looking at it lackadaisically as we might have once upon a time. So,
well, one consequence of the polarization is that it's easy to build the case that elections matter, right?
Right.
Because the choices are stark.
They really are. We'll leave it there. Dr. Gerald Mast, a professor of political science at Carthage College. I knew this would be a really fun conversation and interesting, and indeed it was. I appreciate each and every opportunity to talk with you on the morning show, and I thank you for making time for the program in your busy schedule to be with me today. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert and her monthly visit to the morning show. Her guest will be someone from the